You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, if it ever felt like your mind was playing tricks on you, you might have been right. While most of us like to think of ourselves as rational and truthful, our brains work in a way that sometimes can deceive us and others, on a daily basis even. Those lies can range from an interaction at the coffee shop to our romantic relationships, and oftentimes they can actually be helpful. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the way our brain works sometimes to deceive us? Have you noticed the role of self-deception in your own life or seen it on a bigger scale? Do you have a routine or ritual that you know doesn't actually do anything to make life better, the world better, but for some reason you do it and it helps you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Shankar Vedantam is the host of Hidden Brain, which airs Saturdays at 2 p.m. here on the Ideas Network. He's author of the book Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. Shankar, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Well, I've had this thought, and you write that you have to, if we could just all be reasonable people and only work with the facts and the right stuff, we'd all get along and solve our problems. Not that simple, it turns out.
Yeah, not that simple. And we see lots of examples of it in our lives. Certainly in the news media, we've all had the experience of fact-checking a politician and sometimes coming up with, you know, thousands of corrections to things that a politician may have said and seeing that it has almost no impact whatsoever. The only people whom it convinces are the people who didn't like the politician to begin with, and the people who like the politician largely ignore what we say in the media. And that's a small example of a much larger phenomenon, which is that as we go through our lives, Rob, very often we look and see and hear and remember what it is we want to look and see and hear and remember.
Part of the problem is this, if it's a problem even, is this fundamental thing that our brain does. And this kind of blows my mind to think about it. When I look around the room here, I think I'm seeing everything and taking it all in. My brain is actually kind of finessing things to save processing power. What's going on there?
Yeah, so many of us think of our brains as functioning like a camera or a microphone or a filing cabinet, that our brains are basically taking in reality for what it is. But in fact, that's not the case. And if you thought about it for a moment, you'd realize why that couldn't be the case. There is so much going on around us all the time that, in fact, it would not be functional for us to actually see reality for what it is. The most practical and simple example I can give you is what happens as you look out through your eyes. You know, at any given moment, the human eye takes in about 1 billion bits of information. Only about 1 million bits of that, so reduced by a factor of 1,000, are sent to the brain. And the brain then discards most of that and keeps about 40 bits of information in any given moment. And so it's basically taking in 1 billion bits that come in through the eye, and the brain processes about 40 bits of that. The vast majority of what we see, what the eyes take in, are sort of essentially ignored by the brain altogether. And the reason for this, you could argue this is a delusion, but in fact it's functional because it helps us basically not take in things that would overwhelm us. And it also helps direct us to things that could actually be useful for us to pay attention to. So our memories, for example, of the past are not an accurate and complete recollection of everything that took place in the past. They're in many ways a selective recollection of things that took place, often with a view of guiding us, guiding our actions, behavior, and our thoughts in specific directions.
And at another level, our brains can deceive us. You give a lot of examples in the book of cases where our minds lead us to be maybe more optimistic about one thing compared to reality or more pessimistic. Why would we evolve to have brains that want to kind of, you know, ease away from the truth from us from time to time?
Yeah, I'm glad you used the word evolution, because in so many ways, I think our brains are the product of evolution. And let me give you the simplest example that in some ways will make things really clear of why it is evolution has woven self-deception into the brain. And the example I want to give you is the issue of parenting. We've all known, those of us who are parents, but also those of us who have parents, which is all of us, how difficult it can be to raise children and how challenging it can be to raise children. And when parents think about their children, especially when a child is born, you know, most parents have the experience that I had, which is you imagine that your child, this baby who's born to you, is the most special child in the history of the universe, a miracle beyond all miracles. And of course, when you step back and look at it, you know that this possibly can't possibly be true. It cannot be the case that millions of parents, each of whom believe that their children is the most special child in the universe, it can't be that they're all correct. And yet this is a very useful delusion for us to have as parents. And you know, the answer is sort of blindingly obvious of why this is. Parenting is so hard, it's so difficult, it's so time-consuming, it's so expensive, that it helps for parents to have delusional beliefs about the uniqueness and specialness of their children. And this, in fact, goes back long before humans arrived on the planet. Parents who had a cavalier attitude toward their children, those children would have been less likely to survive and pass on their genes. And so parents who selectively saw their children as unique and special and miraculous were more likely to invest the resources and time in raising those children. Those children, in turn, were more likely to pass on their genes to subsequent generations. And in turn, self-deception essentially becomes embedded in the brain. Now, I want to be careful. I'm not saying that self-deception is always a good thing. There are numerous cases you can point to that show how self-deception can be very dangerous and very troubling. The point that my book is trying to make is that we've in some ways ignored another side of the equation, which is all the ways in which the self-deceiving brain can be our friend.
Shankar Vedantam is with us talking about his latest book. It's called Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. You can hear him on the Hidden Brain radio show Saturdays at 2 here on the Ideas Network. Join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question, maybe an example for our guest of how our brains can delude us, for better or worse. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Well, one setting you focus in on at one point is healthcare. And of course, I think being a reasonable person, I want my doctor, nurse, whoever, to give me the straight story. Don't sugarcoat it, doc, except in many cases, you point out when it is sugarcoated, people have better outcomes or at least suffer less. How does that work?
Yeah, when most of us experience illness, it is not just the biological experience of illness that we're experiencing. We're also experiencing the psychological effects of what it means to be sick. Think back to the last time that you were sick, really felt sick. You know, you probably experienced feelings of loneliness and isolation and fear and anxiety and all of these psychological correlates of what it actually means to be sick. This is why when we turn to doctors for help, when we turn to the healthcare system for help, we're often not just turning to what they know as scientists and as experts, we're also turning to them as human beings. All of us have been to doctors who are very skilled and knowledgeable, but in fact are not very compassionate. And we find that we do not fare as well when we have those doctors. We gravitate towards doctors and nurses and physicians and other healthcare workers who extend compassion to us. There have been a wide variety of studies across many different domains of medicine that show that patients who have an optimistic view of their own conditions, their own disorders, their own diseases, their own disabilities, these patients tend to have better outcomes. Some of the studies have even shown that you might even live longer when you have a terminal illness if you have a positive outlook on your own situation. And again, this is not to say that we should trust every doctor or that they cannot be con men and swindlers and cheaters in medicine who basically lead us astray with fake cures. All of that is absolutely possible. But it is to say that I think when we all fall sick, we are right to seek out the insights and lessons of science. We are right to seek out the best hospitals, the best doctors, the best experts. But we're also right to seek out, in some ways, comfort and care, the things that our self-deceiving brain needs to make us feel whole once again.
And you mentioned fake cures, but a lot of times fake cures can really help. I mean, there's placebos, and I'm a big believer in placebos, but this blew me away. Placebo arthroscopic surgery for people with arthritis. Tell us that story, please.
Yeah, so the placebo has been known for a very long time to be a very powerful intervention. You know, there are many pharmaceutical industry studies testing new drugs where the trials essentially fail because people on the placebo arm of the study do as well as people who are receiving the actual drug. Now, when that happens, typically we think, okay, this drug is ineffective, it doesn't work. But really, it would be more accurate to say the effects of the drug are limited to the placebo effect, which is not zero. The effects of the placebo drug, the placebo arm, are usually not zero. We've typically thought of placebos in the context of medications. You know, you take a sugar pill, for example, when you have a placebo. But the placebo is not really just about a pill. It's really about all the things that a medical system can do to help you feel better. And in fact, there's some research that shows that even when it comes to placebos, the bigger and the more dramatic the placebo, the bigger and the more dramatic effect the placebo can have on you. And when you think about different interventions in medicine, you know, surgery might be the ultimate intervention, the ultimate, you know, medical intervention, where it has a lot of drama and theater. You know, you're actually operated on in something called an operating theater. And there have been studies that have shown when it comes to disorders like arthroscopy, for example, you know, there are surgical procedures that are widely used around the world. But some studies find that if you do fake surgeries, in other words, you're subjecting some people in the study to the real surgery and some people to the fake surgery, people who receive the fake surgery show tremendous improvement. Now, again, I want to be very clear. I'm not suggesting that all surgery is about the placebo effect. I'm not suggesting that real medications are not better than fake cures. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that in many ways, as a medical systems and as a healthcare systems, we often undercount and undervalue the importance of the psychological experience people are having when they're sick. And by underestimating this, we're removing from our quiver one of the most important interventions we have to help people recover and get better.
We're talking to Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain, about his book, Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've heard a few examples of the way our brains can deceive us, sometimes for our own good. Have you ever noticed this at work in your own life? Do you have a question about how all of this works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time.
The eighth season of Wisconsin Life on PBS Wisconsin offers plenty to get excited about. Host Angela Fitzgerald connects viewers with people whose passions, experiences, and expertise celebrate the best of Wisconsin. New episodes air 7 p.m. Thursdays on PBS Wisconsin. Episodes are also available to stream at pbswisconsin.org and on the free PBS video app, on streaming devices and smart TVs.
The 2011 political district map changed the game for Wisconsin.
You know, it was pretty much of a Democratic landsliding. You know, we got wiped out. And then somebody said to me, well, don't worry, we're still in control of the assembly. I said, how can that be?
Listen to WPR Reports Mapped Out and find out why maps matter so much. It's at WPR.org/mapped out or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain, author of the book Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rebecca is with us in Madison. Rebecca, hi.
Oh, hi.
What did you want to ask about, Rebecca?
As I was listening, I was thinking, well, I wonder, are some people better at self-delusion than others? Are they happier than people who are not as good at self-delusion? And what about people who suffer from depression? Does that have anything to do with self-delusion? Are they worse at self-delusion?
Rebecca, great questions. I want to throw this to Shankar.
Yeah, those are really profound questions, Rebecca. People have actually struggled with these questions for many, many years. You know, initially, 30, 40 years ago, it was believed that people who were mentally healthy were seeing the world accurately, and people with mental disorders, especially disorders like depression or anxiety, were seeing the world with a delusional pessimism. But recent studies over the last 20 or 30 years have actually challenged that view, and they've challenged the view in a very surprising way, I think, because they've actually found that in many, many domains, people who have certain mental disorders, especially disorders like depression or anxiety, might in fact be seeing the world more accurately than people who are quote-unquote mentally healthy. And this body of research has argued that seeing the world optimistically may in fact be part of what it means to be mentally healthy. So when someone is suffering from depression or anxiety, part of what you want to do is not so much tell them, here's what the world actually looks like, but to change their perspective on the world so that they start to see more of the upside. They start to see the glass as being more half full rather than half empty. And I think that's really a powerful way to sort of understand how the self-deceiving brain works, because it turns out that when it comes to mental health, seeing the world for exactly what it is might not be a prescription for the best mental health. In fact, all of us have been through a terrible pandemic for the last 12 months. All of us have probably experienced moments of great fear and worry. Some of us have actually lost loved ones. Maybe some of us have lost jobs. Many of us are worried about our health, our communities. Through all of this, we've all found various rituals and ways to keep us healthy, to keep us hopeful for the future. I know for my own part, every month of the past year, I've told myself that liberation was 30 days away. And the fact that I could imagine that liberation was 30 days away helped me in some ways, survive and cope with the difficulties of the past year. And you could say, well, it was clearly delusional to believe, you know, in April last year or May last year, that the pandemic would be wrapped up in a month. And the answer might be yes, it may in fact have been a little delusional to have imagined that things would be wrapped up quickly. But in fact, it may have been a source of mental health to basically imagine that if all I had to do was hold on for a brief amount of time, things would be better. This speaks also to the idea that you see in many, you know, alcohol addiction recovery groups or people who are in prison for long periods of time. They often have the aphorism, you know, take it one day at a time. And the reason you take things one day at a time is not because taking things one day at a time means you're seeing reality more accurately than if you see, you know, the future 20 years at a time. It just as it becomes more manageable if you see your future one day at a time. So in some ways, it's a mental hack. It might be a delusion, but in fact, it might produce better outcomes and better mental health. That's a great question, Rebecca.
Thanks a lot for that call. Sharon from Appleton emailed to ask, could you please discuss this topic as it concerns religion? And I think you can, Shankar.
Yeah, so I think there's been a lot of study looking at sort of why it is that religions have evolved over the centuries. You know, there's hardly been any human culture over the last several thousand years that has not had religious beliefs. And certainly within the field of psychology, many people have tried to understand religion almost at the level of a really important social innovation. The religion in some ways came about to help societies of humans perform really, really complicated and difficult things that might not have been possible earlier. Some research has suggested that religions arose at a time when human societies went from being, you know, hunter-gatherer societies, you know, small isolated groups of 100 or 150 people, to much larger, you know, agrarian agriculture-based societies involving thousands of people. And the old rules of social contact where, you know, I knew everyone in my little group and I could evaluate whether they were trustworthy or not, those rules broke down as humans began to live in larger and larger groups. And religions arose partly as a way to solve problems of trust and communication and how to keep people in line and how to get people to act in terms of the common good. So from this point of view, the belief systems of religion, in fact, regardless of whether they are actually true or not, might in fact play a deeply functional role in many of our lives. Many people turn to religion at times of great difficulty. I know in my own family, I know many family members who are deeply religious who have become even more religious over the past 12 months because turning to a higher spirit, turning to a higher power has given them comfort in the course of the last 12 months, over the course of the pandemic. So from my point of view, from the point of view of the book, I would argue that religion is a really powerful social innovation. And the belief systems of religion, regardless of whether they are factually true or not, might in fact be playing an extremely potent role in keeping us healthy and happy.
And Shankar, in our last couple minutes, can we learn from the positive side of our self-deluding brain to help confront some of the harmful delusions that are out there, big, large-scale conspiracy theories, for example?
Yeah, so I think the model that I'm painting about the delusional brain is a model where the brain really is trying to mediate between an inside world and an outside world. And what I mean by that, Rob, is that we have a set of internal needs and fears and hopes and desires and an external set of reality that's coming in. And the brain is really mediating between these two things. It's playing arbitrage, if you will, between these two things. And when you understand delusions from this perspective, you understand that the reason the brain filters the outside world is because of our evolutionary history or because of the loyalties we have towards different groups. It does give us special insight into how you can dismantle dangerous delusions. Many of us are so upset by the content of dangerous delusions that we don't stop to ask, what are the psychological purposes this delusion is performing? And if we did, we might approach those delusions very differently. For one thing, we would be much more curious about them. We would ask the people who have the dangerous delusions a lot of questions. We would say, explain your delusion to me. Explain this belief system that you have. Explain how it works. And try and understand what would happen to this person if they were to give up this belief system. What are the losses that they would experience if they were to give up this belief system? I'm not suggesting that this would be an easy way to dismantle dangerous delusions, but I certainly think it would be a much more effective way to dismantle dangerous delusions than the approach that we take now, which is simply to confront dangerous delusions with factual counterclaims and basically say, your belief system can't be true because here are the set of peer-reviewed studies that I have against it.
Shankar, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Shankar Vedantam. He's host of Hidden Brain. You can hear him every Saturday at 2 p.m. on the Ideas Network. We've been talking with him about his book, his latest book, I should say. It's called Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then from ancient plagues to COVID-19, our guest says there's a lot we can learn from history when it comes to dealing with infectious disease on a global scale. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. There was a lot of talk about the phrase flattening the curve in the early days of the novel coronavirus. The idea was to try to reduce the spiking number of infections to give hospitals and vaccine developers a chance to catch up. In his new book, our next guest looks at another much bigger disease curve that has been flattening over a much longer period of time. The cycle of infectious diseases killing off huge parts of populations for millennia. He says, we're in a much better place now, but we've got to be careful about where we go next. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How have you been reflecting on the coronavirus pandemic as it compares to other historic outbreaks of infectious diseases? Do you have thoughts on what we could do to be better prepared as a state, a country, a world for whatever the next infectious disease might look like? Do you have a question about the history? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Kenny is senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. He's authored the book The Upside of Down, Why the Rise of the Rest is Good for the West. His latest book is called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be back with you.
A lot of us have been thinking about global disease for the last year and a half. You started thinking about it a lot earlier because this book was a few years in the making before we even heard of COVID-19. What got you thinking about this broad scope, this broad sweep of our disease history?
I'm interested in global progress. I work in global development and used to work at the World Bank and now work in this think tank that thinks about how we can speed global progress. And if you look at sort of the most unarguable statement about the improving condition of humanity, I think it involves children. we have gone from a world where the average parent would expect to bury at least one of their children before the age of five, to that being a rarity worldwide. We've gone from sort of half of children dying young to about one in 25 worldwide over the last two centuries. Pardon me. And you know, you look at that statistic. You look from us going from this tragic situation where you know it is expected to bury a child to that being an all too frequent but still far rarer tragedy today. And you ask why, and the answer is a decline in infectious disease. So I became very interested in why was it declining? You know, what was the story behind that? What was going on? And was there a risk of backtracking? The last sort of 18 months, 2 years sort of helps answer the second part of that question. I started in on the research before COVID-19 began, as you suggested.
Looking at the first part of that story, can you talk about, I mean, you share examples in your book of a lot of major historical plagues, the actual plague and other things we might call plagues. Talk about just what a huge factor in individual lives and even the grand sweep of human society disease was until really just, a couple hundred years ago?
Absolutely. It sort of drove the entire nature of the world economy, if you will. So basically, civilization is a disaster for human health, to put it bluntly, because what agriculture and civilization did was it took a bunch of humans who were hunter-gatherers and it stuck them much closer together at much higher density with a lot of animals who fostered diseases that could jump species, you know, much like we think probably COVID-19 jumped species from bats. Other diseases jump species from our domesticated animals. So, you know, pigs and chickens get flu and so on. Cows get something akin to measles. So packing a whole load of people very close together in constant contact with their animals led to a firestorm of disease and hugely increased young mortality and infant mortality. That alone had a big effect, not least on women who just in order to keep sort of populations constant, the average woman had to have sort of six or seven children. Half of them got pregnancy-related illnesses. Many of them, you know, sadly died during pregnancy and childbirth. So, you know, hugely bad for humans in general. They saw worse health outcomes, in particular bad for women. And infection was such a burden that it basically, you know, stopped empires spreading, stopped cities getting bigger, because the bigger cities got, the more they became death traps, the more infection killed. And so there was sort of a limit to how large cities could get, and a limit to how large civilizations could get. Rome grew to be one of the largest empires in world history, but was felled not least by the first appearance of Yersinia pestis, the plague of the Black Death, which sort of wiped out large parts of the population of the Roman Empire, and in particular large parts of the Roman army, was one factor in the continuing decline of Rome. And 800, 900 years later, you see the cycle repeat with the Black Death wiping out a third to a half of the population of Europe. And it's only with our advances against infection, it's only with proper sanitation systems, public health laws and regulations, and in particular the sort of the medical revolution of vaccines and antibiotics and so on, that we've managed to push down this burden of disease in such a way that nowadays cities are healthier places to live than rural areas worldwide. On average, city dwellers live longer than rural populations. Nowadays, traveling to another country is not a death sentence like it used to be. It's what's allowed for global cities like, you know, New York or London, with their populations of 10, 15 million, a third of whom come from other countries. It's, you know, the only thing that allows those cities to survive and be the creative centers of the global economy today. And it's the only thing that's allowed for a revolution in women's rights as well. If you don't have to have seven or eight children per woman in order just to keep populations constant. If you can get that down to, you know, two, close to two as it is worldwide today, that frees up a lot of time that women were spending, you know, in pregnancy and childbirth, but also, you know, massively improves their health, massively improves their possibility to take, you know, equal part in society in general. So it has all sorts of effects on the global economy. It improves education outcomes, encourages people to get more educated. I could go on, but it really is a vital part of a story that takes us from a world where most people are living in extreme poverty, most children are dying in childhood, to a world where most people are living, you know, on incomes multiples of what they used to, and most people are living, you know, past the age of 70.
Talking to Charles Kenny about his new book, The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. You could join the conversation with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Charles, you worry in your book about some very particular risks we have of disease, but also more generally, I think, of a kind of complacency. A lot of us in the world now grow out without that daily risk of horrific infectious disease outbreaks, and maybe we're letting our guard down.
I think that really is a large risk. You know, even today, even after what we've gone through in the last 2 years, we see complacency around making sure the world as a whole works together to reduce the, you know, future risk of new pandemics, but also to sort of finish the job of wiping out infections that are still killing millions worldwide. Just to take some examples, if you look at tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV, last year their death toll was probably about the same as the official death toll from COVID-19. Now, COVID-19 actually killed more people than the official death toll. But HIV, malaria, and TB have been killing that many year in, year out, killing it more than that many year in, year out, you know, for decades. And we've sort of let them fester because they kill poor people in poor countries. And so we sort of, you know, largely, I'm afraid, as a global society, don't particularly care. We use antibiotics at the moment, these magical weapons against bacterial infection. 90% of antibiotics we have, we don't use to cure humans from infectious disease. We use them in order to make factory-farmed animals grow a bit fatter, a bit faster. The risk of developing antibiotic resistant diseases amongst those animals that can then jump species to humans is huge. But, you know, because we like our cheap meat, we're willing to take that risk. So in all sorts of different ways, we're acting as if, you know, we don't care, we don't see the threat, and we're still doing it today. I mean, just to take an example, the Build Back Better bill that is still going through Congress, you know, partially as a pandemic response, it's been cut down from its original size. But one of the things that's been most cut in it, it's been cut by 2/3 of the pandemic response measures in it. You know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic that's killing thousands of Americans a week, and yet already we're sort of cutting back. We're reducing our ambition when it comes around to pandemic preparedness. So I agree. I think there is this sort of this problem of success we face, that in a world where, you know, half the population was dying from infectious disease, it was really hard to ignore. Now we're in a world where, thanks to medical progress and thanks to public health, that doesn't happen anymore. We do seem to be sort of reasonably blasé about the deaths that remain and the threat of many more deaths in the future.
We're talking to Charles Kenny about his new book, The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. We're going to look at some of what our guest says are lessons for the future from COVID-19 and past diseases. Do you have thoughts? Do you want to see more effort put into public health here in the United States or into curing diseases around the world, even if they don't affect the U.S. Directly? Do you think there are things we could have done better with COVID-19 that maybe with the next pandemic, whatever it might look like, we could do better next time around? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Wisconsin Public Radio stays connected with the whole state thanks to its network of 7 bureaus. With reporters on the ground across Wisconsin, WPR provides a news service that connects with issues that matter to your life. Stay in touch with WPR.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Charles Kenny from the Center for Global Development. We're looking at his new book. It's called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease, looking at lessons from all of human history, plus the latest with COVID-19, lessons that can help us avoid going back to the bad old days when infectious disease was a very real threat to daily human life and even civilizations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there a lesson you hope, say, American policymakers can learn from COVID-19 and the response there? Do you have a question for our guest about disease and history? And on a personal note, how about, I know our guest is curious, how about those COVID booster shots? Are you going to get one if you've already been vaccinated? Do you worry about the choice, you getting a booster or somebody getting their first shot in a poorer country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Charles, I understand that is something that's on your mind. Some in the U.S. getting their third shots, a lot of countries around the world waiting for their first shots for people.
Yeah, I should admit, I got my third shot. I'm in a slightly higher risk group, thanks to a heart condition. And so I was, you know, in the list that the CDC said, maybe you want to get a third shot. And I did. But as I got my third shot, as I sat there feeling incredibly grateful for medical progress and for these vaccines, you know, I couldn't help but think about the vast majority of people, even in high-risk groups in low-income countries worldwide, that haven't had their first shot yet. We are managing this vaccine rollout in a better way than we've ever done in history before, by which I mean it looks like the whole world will get to, you know, 50-60% vaccinated way faster than we managed with smallpox or with measles or with diphtheria or pertussis or tetanus. Sort of name your previous vaccine rollout effort. We're going to get from zero to 60-ish faster than ever before. In that way, it's a great global triumph. On the other hand, it is terrible how badly we've done compared to how well we could have done. Rich countries, including the United States, are sitting on so many vaccines that they're expiring before we can use them. Meanwhile, in poor countries, terribly, you know, high-risk communities, you know, the very old and so on, are sitting there without a vaccine, access to a vaccine at all. It's just sort of, it's morally wrong, it's repugnant. And so, you know, I did the selfish thing. I protected myself a bit more. I wish the system was better set up so, you know, next time we vaccinate more people more faster and much more equitably, you know, in particular, vaccinating those who need the vaccine most first.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Catherine is with us in Menominee Falls. Catherine, hi.
Hi, I guess you're speaking to a pretty biased person here, but I have sincere concerns for people who have had difficulty with COVID, but we lost 4 family members to cancer in the last 5 years, including my beloved husband. And I cannot believe that there's no cure for cancer when we've had we have never had a sitting president in this country with cancer.
Catherine, thank you so much. I'm so sorry for your loss and your family there. Cancer is a different kind of disease, Charles. It's not as, I guess, some kinds of cancer can relate to certain kinds of infection. I'm thinking HPV here. But it operates differently than the infectious diseases you're talking about.
It does. And I join you in being terribly sorry for the listeners' loss. Cancer is now, you know, one of the greatest killers in the United States, one of the greatest killers worldwide. You know, because infectious disease deaths have gone down so much, sadly, people still die in the end, and more are dying from cancer and heart disease. I too have experienced some recent losses from both, and I don't mean to, downplay the horror. And I think we do need to make more rapid progress against those diseases. And I think that too should be very much a public health priority. And as we make further advances against infection, even more of a public health priority than it is today. As you say, some cancers can be prevented by vaccines, and HPV is one example where we've seen really dramatic recent evidence of the efficacy of vaccines in saving lives against some cancers. And I hope maybe one of the silver linings that comes out of the COVID-19 period and the research into these new types of vaccines like the mRNA vaccines is that we see more cancers that can be treated by vaccines. We see more vaccines developed against them. That'll only be, one part of the story of the fight against cancer. But I hope it's a part of a story that's been given a boost by the last 2 years.
Catherine, thanks for that call. We're talking to Charles Kenny about his new book called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. Charles, I want to get another prescription for the future that you're looking for. You mentioned reining in the use of antibiotics, especially among animals, as one cure, investing in public health or not stopping our investments in public health. You're also hoping to see more and more effective international communication on diseases. What would that look like?
At the moment, the World Health Organization, our sort of international body that's meant to look after global health, its core budget is about the same as one large US hospital. It's a really underfunded part of the global architecture. And I know it doesn't do everything perfectly right, far from it. And I think it really made some mistakes in its early calls on things like masking, suggesting that maybe masking wasn't a priority during the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you can argue forever about what it said about where the virus came from, but it still plays a vital role in coordination. Even during COVID-19, it played a really important role in coordinating trials of various treatments against COVID-19. Those trials can run faster if they take place where there's a lot of COVID-19 infection going on. And so being able to move trials around the world to sort of where the pandemic is at that stage is a really powerful way to increase the accuracy and speed of our trials of potential cures and vaccines and so on. So there's just a really big role for better international coordination on this in this area. And in particular, there's a big role for the immediate response. The best way to deal with a pandemic is immediately emerges before it spreads around the world. What we really want is every country having the capacity, the domestic capacity or domestic capacity supported by the international community, to respond to pandemic outbreaks, at source really rapidly, close it down there before it spreads across borders, before it goes worldwide. If we'd managed that with COVID-19, think of the lives saved, think of the trillions of dollars saved as well. Next time, I hope we get together as a global, before next time, I hope we get together as a global community and coordinate far more on thinking, how do we get instantaneous response to outbreak threats and really get the support to where they're happening in real time so that we can shut them down before they spread.
Just 30 seconds or so, Charles, you've immersed yourself in studying these scary diseases for 5+ years now. Did you come out of this feeling more optimistic or pessimistic about our disease future?
Optimistic. I have worries. We could muck it up. We could allow new pandemics to spread. We could allow old infections to come back. But we've seen in the last 2 years, we've seen in the last 2 centuries, what we can achieve as humanity against these infections. And I think we're going to continue making that sort of progress. I certainly hope we do.
Charles, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rob.
That's Charles Kenny, senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. We talked to him about his latest book. It's called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. If you want to listen back to this full conversation or hear any of the discussions we've had on Central Time, you can find them all on our online archives. Those are at WPR.org, along with a lot more. Articles from WPR's news department, podcasts, and live streams of WPR's two networks. And we're always happy to hear from you. If there's an issue you think needs more attention on the air, or if there are people working on it in your part of Wisconsin, we want to know about it. You can email us at centraltime@wpr.org. I know what you're thinking. It's time for some more millipede news. A couple weeks back, I mentioned the discovery in Australia of a millipede that actually had over 1,000 legs. The word millipede means 1,000 legs. Most of them, though, have 700 or fewer, it turns out. But here's another discovery, a fossil of a millipede found in England of a creature almost 9 feet long. As reported by NPR, researchers in England were on a road trip when they stopped at a promising site and saw a boulder that had fallen from a cliff. There was a big crack in it, and there was this millipede fossil that turned out to be 300 million years old, give or take. This was a 3-foot chunk of fossil. They were able to calculate the full length, again, just under 9 feet. If they're right about that length, that would be the largest known arthropod. That's the group that includes insects, spiders, lobsters, and more. It's a cool discovery, but I gotta say I'm happy to have 300 million years between this guy and me. This is Central Time.